The following story has been brought to you by StoriesToInspire.org.
Rabbi Twersky is a magnificent man. He's a scholar, but he's also a psychologist, and he works on helping people who struggle with terrible addictions, with terrible problems. And he went into a prison, and he's sitting there talking with hardened criminals. I don't know if you know this, but in prison, when someone gets out, it is incredibly likely that that will not be the last time that they will be in prison. 68% of people who check out of a prison, in the statistics they took last, I think it was back in 2005, 68% of prisoners that they polled would be back in prison within 3 years, within 2 years. A full 77% would be back in three. So he sat there talking to the prisoners and he asked them, why is it that this happens? Why? You want to be on an uncomfortable bed stuck in a prison cell? You know, you want to be served this kind of food? You want someone to tell you when you can get up and when you can go to the bathroom and when you can go outside and see the light of day? Is that what you want? It's not what you want, he says. It's because you don't think you're good enough to be able to succeed out there in the world. He says, but I'm here to tell you that the behavior that you're exhibiting, it's beneath all of you. That's what he said. You're better than this. You're brighter than this. And he's giving this talk, and there's hardened criminals who are sitting there and they're crying because someone thinks actually that this is not who they are, that their circumstances maybe made them this way in certain cases, that maybe there was a possibility of leading a different or a better life. But there's one boy, his name is Josh, and he's sitting there with his hands crossed and he's shaking his head the whole time. And finally the rabbi finishes. He says, Rabbi, you're talking a load of baloney. He did not use the word baloney. Everyone was very, you know, affected. They said, how could you say this? The rabbi, he's here. Da, 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 da. And Josh says, what do you want from my life? The guy's talking. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't know anything about me. He thinks I'm a good person. Does he know what I've done? Does he know where I've been? The rabbi says to him, I think you're mistaken, but it sounds to me like this is a conversation we should have in private. Josh says, okay. They go out into another room. And Josh starts to tell him about the time when he was 10 years old, when his father checked out and his mother couldn't care less. And the kids were at home and they didn't have food because the mother would just go on drug trips. And they'd be asking neighbors until eventually neighbors called social services. And at the age of 10, he says, my sister and I were sent into foster care. There's only two words there, foster care, he says, and one of them is a lie. From the first house I went to, I was sent to a house where they had seven children, and he was fostering another five. Only reason why they had us was because they would get the foster check. My parents, he said, my foster parents wouldn't give us any food. If there was any food at all, moldy bread, a little bit of something, whatever they had in the house, and then we'd be sent off to school. I didn't dare ask for any extra food, he said, because I'd get beaten by my father, or even beaten by my foster mother. He said, so at the age of 10 years old, I went to school. And all of a sudden I saw in someone's briefcase, there was a sandwich. He says, I didn't think. I grabbed the food out and started eating as quickly as I could. I was a thief at the age of 10. And even though they made fun of me, and even though I got in trouble, he said, my hunger was stronger than my pride. What started off as sandwiches eventually got worse. Until one day, after the principal called my parents in because I'd stolen something a little bit more valuable, my mother gave me the beating of my life. And that night, he says, I grabbed whatever I could from the house that I thought I'd be able to sell, stuffed it into my briefcase, my school knapsack, and I ran away. And he looked at the rabbi with tears in his eyes and he says, Rabbi, no one ever came looking for me. They carried on cashing the check, happy that they had one less mouth to feed. And now I'm on the streets. He says, and I got good, stealing watches, stealing beepers, stealing phones, whatever I could get my hands on. 6 times I've been in prison, he says, Rabbi. He says, I've seen the worst side of the world. I've seen the worst side of myself. He says, and I don't actually believe that there's another side of me. Rabbi Twersky is sitting there the whole time quiet. Finally, he finishes. And Rabbi Twersky says, you're wrong. He says, remember the last time you were in a jewelry store looking at the diamond necklace? And instantly his face, he blushes. Rabbi's called him out. He says, yes. He says, do you think it started out like that? Someone somewhere was down in a mine and saw a lump, black as coal, covered in mud. And what was it? It was a 10-carat diamond. But using your logic, what would you do? You'd step right past it, toss it in the garbage. All it took was for someone to pick it up, to realize its worth, to spend a little bit of time polishing off all the soot and the garbage and the muck upon it. And then it took someone to cut a couple of painful facets into its side, for the person to cut something out of himself, to do a little teshuvah, a little song, a little bit of a tefillah, a little bit of mamon, to give a little bit away of himself, to cut pieces off, because that's how diamonds shine. They take a piece off of themselves. If you leave the diamond in its fullest amount, yes, there's more of it. But it's pointless in that shape, in that form. And he says, if you're willing to do that, you'll start to see that there's a diamond there too. And Josh, by now, is silenced. It's the first time someone's taken the time to talk to him about him like this. Someone who wasn't their job. They weren't getting paid for it. And Josh checks in and starts working. And slowly but surely, my dear friends, he does a turnaround. 2 years go by. He's now hired by the halfway house that he's staying in since he's no longer in prison. And one day, the head of the halfway house, this woman, Shelley, she says to him, you know, someone just called in and they said that they have a lot of furniture. An old woman passed away. Could you go to the house and pick up this furniture and bring it to the halfway house? They want to donate it. He says, sure. He jumps in a truck, drives to the halfway house, gets to this apartment. It smells. Everything smells like mold and mothballs. And he calls Shelley up and he says, ma'am, you know, nothing here is worth taking. Everything is broken. Everything is... And the woman says to him, she says, you know, just take it. They're going to feel bad that we didn't want anything. Just take whatever. Take a few things. Tell them we don't need the rest. Josh looks around, he finds the things that are the least broken, that are the least disgusting, he finds one couch, a small couch, he finds one end table, he finds one rocking chair, he says, this is all that we need, and they say, really, you don't need more, what do they want, they just want him to clear the apartment, he says, no, this is all we need, thank you very much, he's dragging these things down the stairs, pivot, okay, he goes all the way down, puts it into the truck, and drives with all this stuff, it's practically falling apart already. He drags it upstairs into the halfway house. The rocking chair, the end table, which by now is already sawdust is coming out of it. He pulls the couch up himself up the stairs and he drags it into the corner. And as he drags it into the corner, he hits a part in the floor and he can hear a spring go toing. So he picks up the cushion to straighten out the spring to see if the couch is even worth keeping. And he sees a cloth wrapped up amongst the springs. He reaches his hand in, pulls it out, and unfolds it, and he sees bills stacked with rubber bands, 20s, 50s, 100s, and he counts slowly, quietly, making sure nobody sees. His heart is racing. It's $3,200. For someone like this, it's a gold mine. Nobody knows. The family just wanted to give it away, and they get away with it. Nobody has seen that it's here. There's no cameras in the halfway house. So he puts it in his pocket. He walks out and he says to Shelley, he says, you know, they gave us the garbage. There's nothing here. It's a shame we even brought it back. We're probably going to have to throw it out. And Shelley says to him, it's true, Josh. But when we told them we were coming, we had to honor our word and do the right thing, even if it's just going to make more work for us and it's not going to be the easy thing. And her words rip through him. And the money is burning a hole in his pocket he hasn't stolen in 2 years. And he takes the money out of his pocket and he says, oh, I found this in the couch. Shelley opens it up. She says, what do you mean? There's $3,200 here. He says, I know. It must be the old woman's. We should return it to the inheritor, to the people for the inheritance. She says, well, I can't believe it. I knew your whole life. All you did was steal. And here you are with a chance. No one knew that you had it. You're giving it back. And Josh says, we got to do the right thing, even when it's not the easy thing. Mamon mimenu. She calls up Rabbi Twersky to say, I just want to tell you about what your student, what your charge has done today. Rabbi Twersky comes to meet him, gives him a big hug, and he says, I guess we finally polished our diamond. This is a man who was thrown into prison for 27 months for stealing shampoo and a t-shirt from Walmart. This is a man who took every chance he had to swipe five-finger discount. But a time comes where someone sees that there's light in him. Someone chooses to light him up, and in that moment, Rabotai, becomes someone special. Tonight, when you light the Chanukah candles, I want you all to ask yourselves and your children, what's it going to be? Rav Shlomo Freifeld used to say that we have an obligation to mimic God. We mimic God by being kind. We mimic God by being gracious. We mimic God by being forgiving. But Rav Shlomo Freifeld says that in the prayers every morning we say, Ve'ata mechaye et kulam, you God, you bring life to every living thing. Every moment that we breathe is God saying, breathe, live, innovate. It's God breathing that into our nostrils. Says Rav Freifeld, if we are obligated to mimic God, then we too are obligated to breathe life into every human being we come into contact with. That is our job. That is our gift. That is our honor.
Enjoyed this story? Come again. Bring a friend. StoriesToInspire.org.